So yes, the stellar dynamical mass of M87 and a couple of others here. This is the heart of the work here is that I'm going to be talking about is a paper, Gebhardt et al. References there. If you fall asleep now, you should at least take away this. The stellar dynamical mass of the black hole in M87 is 6.6 plus or minus 0.4 by 10 to the 9 solar masses. That's at a distance of 17.9 megaparsecs. The mass scales linearly with distance. And for this audience, perhaps this is the takeaway point here, that gm over c squared d is 3.6 microarc seconds. Multiply that by 2 root 27. And you can see a shadow. If you divide this by 2 and get what the gas dynamical mass is, then you're in trouble. So we want to understand the differences. So I'm going to talk about why you should trust our mass estimate. In order to do this, we're going to have to go into a little bit of the boring details of how we measure black hole masses using the stellar dynamical method, how we apply it to M87, and then I'm going to end up discussing, trying to understand some of the differences between our result and Janelle Walsh's result. Let me at least acknowledge now that I know I'm telling you what you want to hear, whereas Janelle is giving you bad news. I still think we're right about this, but please do keep an open mind until you hear Janelle's talk tomorrow. So, other than seeing shadows of black hole masses are important for a number of reasons. If you care about the accretion, then you need to care about the Eddington limit, and then you need to know the mass. We also just heard about spin measurements. You care about the innermost stable circular orbit. Although it scales with mass, if you want to compare this to, say, some size scale determined by microphysics rather than something that scales with mass, then you need to know what the actual mass is here. There are multiple ways to measure black hole masses. There are different tiers of black hole mass measurements. We're concerned only with primary mass measurements right now. And so I will talk about the stellar dynamical method. Every method uses this equation to find the black hole mass, and we have solved this equation, and we're very proud of this. In more detail, so I guess at least say that astronomy has long been good at measuring V to high precision. Getting R to high precision means high angular resolution. So in order to do this with stellar dynamics, you need to see the stars. So we take a picture of a galaxy. This is not an M87. These are pictures I had lying around. It's very clearly not M87. This is NGC 4026 from a paper wrote in 2009. It's a Sloan image. We want high resolution images, so we get HST images as well. So you have the surface brightness of the galaxy. You can turn this into a luminosity density. This requires some knowledge of the geometry and some knowledge of the viewing angle of that geometry. For our case, we are going to assume axis symmetry, and then we parameterize the inclination. We'll come back to both of these points here. You have a luminosity density, you turn it into a stellar mass density by multiplying it by the mass to light ratio. Which you need to know. In our case, we assume it's constant throughout the galaxy, and we parameterize that value. At least the stellar mass to light ratio is constant. Add to that other sources of mass, like the dark matter halo. We assume a form and parameterize the values there. In the case of M87, this comes from work done by Murphy et al. With excellent data at looking very far out in M87. And then we add a black hole, one single term in here, and we parameterize that value there. All right, we have the mass density. We can solve Poisson's equation, get the gravitational potential. That's great. We're not done getting data yet. We need spectroscopic data, get spectra of the data. In the example here, I'm showing STIS. This is a lie in many ways. The galaxy on the left is not M87. The galaxy on the right is not M87. And this spectra does not come from that galaxy. This is just a schematic of how this works, that you want high spatial resolution getting close in, and you turn these spectra into line of sight velocity distributions. The bottom spectrum here is a template from a star. You can use a mixture of different templates in order to best describe it. The convolution of the template and the line of sight velocity distribution gives you the observed spectrum, so it's an inverse process here. But now you know how the stars are moving. We know where the stars are from the light. And we can now, using the potential, So we can integrate orbits in the potential that we now know, or have parameterized anyway. This is from Remco van den Bosch. This is actually a triaxial orbit in here. But we keep track of how much time this orbit, this representative star, spends in each spatial bin. More time at apocenter, more time when it's crossing over. So we know how much light this particular orbit is contributing at each spatial bin. And we also know its line of sight velocity in each bin that we have there. We do this many times, tens of thousands, 20 of thousands times of different orbits, sampling, in our case, the three integrals for axisymmetric model. And then we combine these to make a model of the galaxy. And so up to now, everything has been pretty straightforward, understanding how we do it. Step 9 is kind of wordy in how we do this. We take all those orbits we have, and we find the weights weighting the orbits. Some of these orbits contribute nothing to building up a model of the galaxy. Some contribute quite a bit. We add them up in such a way, weighted by how many stars are represented by this particular orbit, such that it most closely matches the observed line of sight velocity distribution, subject to the constraint that it reproduces the surface brightness. This is the Schwarzschild orbit library method. As I said, we want lots of orbits in order to ensure that we're doing this right. And it's self-consistent in the sense that we're using the light from the galaxy to create a potential in which we integrate orbits of stars which have to reproduce the light that we originally started with. Step 10 is you do this over all parameter space, and you come up with some chi-squared goodness of fit over black hole mass, and you measure your black hole mass there. So before we get into the details of how we do this for M87, I need to convince you that we've done it correctly, or that it's a reliable method anyway. One great test is NGC 4258, which has a very high precision Maser mass measurement. With the exception of Sag J star, this is the gold standard for measuring black hole masses. And we get within about 2 sigma, and we're actually quite proud of that. This is an awful galaxy for our method. Getting the luminosity density out of the surface brightness here is actually quite messy. There's equivalent widths of the spectral lines that we're using change as a function of radius. So the fact that we're 2 sigma away is actually quite encouraging. And we gives us reason to believe our results here. And that same paper also did sort of blind tests here using simple models of a galaxy, observing it, different Monte Carlo realizations of the noise of the observations of this synthetic galaxy, and able to recover, this is a parameterization of the stellar distribution and kinematics, and this is the black hole mass. And more to the point, the uncertainties that we quote represent the range of values that we get when we do multiple realizations according to the noise that we've synthesized here. So we can trust our uncertainties, which I'd say is at least as important, if not more important, than getting the right answer. Another reason we think we're right is that stellar dynamical masses have been reproduced using different sets of data for different galaxies and different methods here. Each of these different colored lines is a different galaxy using stellar dynamical methods, and also we have the galaxy here. And you can see that these lines are all constant. As a function of publication date, the mass doesn't really change
for the most part here.
No error bars quoted here, but they're all more or less within the uncertainties here.
Using different data sets, sometimes overlapping data sets, and different codes to do this modeling. Something that was supposed to be a great test was this Galaxy NGC 3706 that I published earlier this year. It's this neat elliptical galaxy where when you zoom in the central parts and you change the scale here, you see this ring feature, you see these limb brightenings here. This is a ring of stars, and we thought we can use our complicated method, measure black hole mass, and then compare it to the circular velocity we get from this ring, and we should be able to compare the methods. Unfortunately, it turned out not to be so simple. That ring, I was not able to model as a simple circular velocity. The best I could come up with was stars that are orbiting in both senses around this in this ring. Some going towards us and some going away from us. I could not get the ratio of V over sigma for the full line of sight velocity distribution to work. And it turns out that that's what the orbit code found as well. This is a kinematic decomposition of the model. If you look at just the red line, that is the line of sight velocity distribution of the stars that are in this ring. There are also foreground and background stars and some that sort of pass in between. But this is the dominant thing of the, at least except for the foreground and background stuff. And it comes with a bimodal distribution. 2/3 of the stars are moving towards us, 1/3 is moving away from us. All I can say is that this is the least crazy idea we could come up with that fits the data. In order to explain this, we invoke a binary black hole that has resonances that can flip, you know, a non-axisymmetric potential. It can flip the inclinations of orbits that are around it as it goes through. This also explains why this ring is misaligned with the axis symmetry of the galaxy, because there's no reason for the binary black hole to be there. But this is pure speculation. Okay, so let's talk about M87 like I said I would. We have our data, Gemini AO plus HST plus ground imaging. These are the data. HST1 over here, this jet knot we talked about, this actually saved us. We were able to measure the PSF with that. We thought it was going to actually cause problems for the AO guiding. It turned out to be great. We have a stellar model, an AGN jet model. These are the residuals with the grayscale really souped up, so we're only off by about 1% at the most compared to the data. We also have spectroscopic Gemini NIFS AO using the CO band head. Here are three example spectra. This is the innermost. The top one is the innermost spatial bin. We threw that out. It's just kind of messy in there. The AGN light, we were not completely happy with being able to subtract that. Just unfortunate, you get a lot of information close in. We also have lots of data out from Sauron and the Virus P for further out, which is great for constraining the mass to light ratio. Here are the results. This is the velocity distribution, velocity dispersion as a function of radius. We have many different position angles. They're all put together. This is our best fit model. It goes right through the data. Here's our chi-squared as a function of black hole mass. We get 6.6 plus or minus 0.4 by 10 to the 9, ruling out the earlier gas measurement. And it turns out that M87 is not strongly dependent on those assumptions we made. Because it's the sphere of influence is so big, the mass-to-light ratio really doesn't matter. The mass enclosed in our innermost spatial bin is dominated by the black hole. Even if we're wrong by the mass-to-light ratio by a factor of 2 or 3, we're still black hole dominated. We also varied the inclination, and it didn't make a difference in our final results. Axisymmetry is the one thing that we can't directly test, but it's unlikely that triaxiality is it's very strongly triaxial at the center of this galaxy just because it has a black hole of some mass whatsoever, and the black hole will tend to scatter box orbits away. So we think that this is not a big problem for us either. So is it weird to have a black hole that is so big in M87? So this is my 2009 M sigma plot.
This is where M sigma used to be, and this is where we put it. It looked like it was an outlier based on what we knew in 2011, based on M sigma, but when we added more BCG galaxies, M87 is not technically a BCG, but has many properties like a BCG. When we do that, and you, which is what McConnell did through several papers, and this is the synthesis looking at it, M87 sits up here. This is with the new mass. It's right in the middle. It's not an extreme outlier up there. It just turns out that these giant galaxies may have black holes that sit up there, or we didn't really know what was going on at the high end because we didn't have enough data there. Same in the M black hole, M bulge relation, middle of the road. So it's not particularly worrying that that it sits where it sits. Okay. It still comes back to the fact that the stellar dynamical mass is double the gas dynamical mass. So let's for a second take what I just said as absolutely correct and consider what could have gone wrong with the gas dynamical mass. My personal feeling is that it's the inclination in the gas dynamics that in the gas disk that we're not completely sure we got right. Although the kinematics look relatively smooth, there is some spiral structure in the gas disk. And I did a quick calculation very late last night, and then I redid it this very early this morning. I got two different answers, so I averaged them. So take it for what it's worth. If you change the inclination to 30 degrees instead of 42 degrees, and our answers, and this isn't the exact right thing to do for the gas dynamical. You need to completely remodel it, and they do include inclination as a parameter. But if there's systematic uncertainties that are forcing them to get the inclination wrong, this would explain it. The jet is also at 14 degrees, we just heard, but I think this is a non sequitur. There's no reason for the large-scale gas disk to have to line up with the jet. So if we look a little bit more closely, this is from Janelle's paper. This is an image of the ionized gas, which they use here. And this needs to be undisturbed, well-ordered, and they need to know the inclination. They get the inclination from the kinematics, and it looks more or less like this. I see structure that looks different from that in this. These are just from their paper. I wasn't able to restretch it. I see a position angle that could be very different at the very center here. We have spiral structure. If we zoom out and look at an older paper, this is the ionized gas looking further out. Definitely spiral structure in here. And zoom even further out, and with a real sort of extremely highlighting of the faint stuff here, we see that at large scales, it is not a well-ordered disk. That doesn't mean it's not a well-ordered disk at smaller scales, but it does allow me to raise the question that maybe it's not as simple as it's being portrayed to be. And it's absolutely critical that we know that the velocities are completely circular in the gas disk in order to get this right. Okay, so let me summarize here. Again, the takeaway home here is the stellar dynamical mass of a black hole in M87 is 6.6 by 10 to the 9. That's at a distance of 17.9 megaparsecs. I hope I've convinced you that the stellar dynamical method is reliable. It's been tested. In the case of M87, it's relatively robust to the assumptions that we've made. And it's not an outlier when we compare this to similar galaxies. And although I'm not positive, we may be able to explain the discrepancy between the stellar dynamical and the gas dynamical measurements. Thank you.
Question? Yes. Including the dark matter halo, which anchors the mass to light ratio at large radii and hence affects the black hole mass.
Yeah, this is absolutely true. This was all done with lower spatial resolution data. When we use the NIFS high spatial resolution data, it doesn't really matter. It absolutely does make a difference when you use the ground-based data because the degeneracy is much harder to break there.
Plenty of time for questions.
you briefly talked about the jet that you were subtracting. Obviously, M87 is a blazar, so we get a strong continuum emission from the jet. And you subtract that as two point sources, or could there also be a diffuse scattered component? Just making something up here. Could there be continuum emission from the disk that you need to take into account?
We don't include it. We subtract it as a series of point sources in a sort of clean, using sort of like a clean-like algorithm in terms of subtracting the AGN light, the AGN plus jet light at the very center. We don't explicitly include a disk term. They're just point sources in the continuum.
More questions?